Welcome to the Up Close Podcast, your home for conversations about the present and future of public education. Today, we'll talk about something that in some places is greatly celebrated and in others, incredibly controversial, if not contentious. And that is the state of anti-racist education in this country and the work of educators who are committed to anti-racism. Before I launch in, I want to say that there are many differing perspectives held about what is required to promote anti-racism as a part of education in this country. And our guest today represents just one view, but she brings a deeply held conviction, and she has acted upon that and made a commitment to anti-racism as a core tenet of her work. So with that, please join me in welcoming to the Up Close Podcast today, Samantha Greenleaf. Hello there, Samantha.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. But for our listeners, before we talk with you, Samantha, I want to share a little bit about your work. So everyone, Samantha currently serves as an assistant principal at Gullett Elementary School in Austin, Texas. She is, among many things, a national board certified teacher. She is a Fulbright teacher for Global Classrooms, but most relevant for our conversation today, she is on the leadership team of Educators in Solidarity, which is a local nonprofit organization in Texas committed to building the capabilities of and the capacities of anti-racist educators. The NEA Foundation was introduced to Samantha this past fall after hearing her speak at a conference in Austin, and we were blown away by her passion for all educators to adopt an anti-racist lens in their work in and outside of the classroom. And we were particularly intrigued by her insistence that the work of creating an anti-racist education is not just the responsibility of educators of color, but of white educators as well. So today, Samantha is here with us to tell us about the work that she has been a part of in Texas and how that work can serve as a model for educators across the country whose aim is to create a public education experience that embraces and uplifts all students. Wow. So, Samantha, I'd like it if we would just start by you telling us a little bit about your journey as an educator. And in particular, what was the aha moment or the experience that made you want to be an anti-racist educator?
Well, thank you so much for that introduction. I greatly admire your work and this podcast. So thank you so much for having me. So a little bit about my experience. And one thing that's been so great about being a part of Educators in Solidarity is very aware of everyone's individual experience. So mine, I began teaching in Jackson, Mississippi. And so I grew up in Louisiana in a somewhat diverse public school system. But I began teaching in Jackson, Mississippi, where I also did my undergraduate work. And one thing that was very apparent in Jackson, there's, of course, a lot of racial history there, but Jackson Public Schools is about 97% African American. And so I learned a lot in that context, but I wasn't able to really dissect a lot of what I was experiencing until I came to Austin. And so what I mean by that is when I came to Austin, I was able to see how there was a lot more different experiences of a lot of different races in our school district. Mm-hmm. When I was in Jackson, experienced a lot of course, there's a lot of high poverty there, but there, if a student was recommended for gifted and talented, for instance, they were Black. If they were suspended, they were most likely a Black student. If they were selected for any organization, I didn't get really see the racial dynamics because I was working with mostly just one racial group in terms of students and most of the teachers. So when I came to Austin and was introduced to a city through the graduate program at UT that I was a part of, not only was I coming into the city through a very educational lens by coming for graduate school, I was also able to work with different ethnic and racial groups of students and kind of see a lot more of those disparities that I was reading about, was able to see them firsthand throughout the school district that I was working in and in the greater context of Texas as well. So educationally and mentally, I was learning that and kind of learning about my place as a white educator, where in Texas, especially, the majority of educators are white women. And so kind of thinking about what is my role in that. So that was an aha for me in that aspect. But one day in particular that really struck me and stood out to me, when I was in my graduate program, we did one of those activities where we kind of got to, I think it was called the I don't remember even what it was called. It was called the circle, the color circle or the color, I can't remember what it was called. I actually think they were still in the process of developing it. But all the members of my cohort at the University of Texas and our professors did an activity where we rated, you know, our comfort levels in certain situations. So if you felt like you could voice something in a setting, if you saw people that looked like you on TV, if you felt comfortable walking to your car, things like that. And then we got in order of based on the scores that we had put down. And it was a very trusted group that we were with. I think for activities like that, you need to be in that sort of setting. But so we got in order and it was very apparent that we were going in, we lined up in order of our lightness to darkness, as well as female, male to female. And so we didn't have any white men in the room, but as a white woman, I was at the, at one end of the line. And then we had an Asian American man, Hispanic woman, Black man, Black woman, and all in a line. And it was, it really struck me because these were people that I had been working alongside for 2 years as this cohort and been learning in terms of data, what, how educators and how students are impacted by race, but kind of seeing that out of the experiences that we all live differently and how we see the world and how comfortable we are in certain settings, that really struck me as another aha of that this is such important work for so many different reasons for our students, for other teachers, and just kind of the world that we're hoping to create. So that was kind of a really a big catalyst for me personally. That was one of the big aha moments that comes to my mind.
Mm-hmm. And when you decided then to learn more about racism and anti-racism initially, Samantha, where did you turn?
Thankfully, that was a huge tenet of the program that I was a part of at the University of Texas. I was a part of their principalship program. And so that was a driving force, and probably I would say the biggest driving force of the education program there as a whole, and particularly the principalship program. And so kind of looking at, there's many factors that impact education, but even when we take out other factors such as socioeconomic status, there's so many predictors that just come down to race. Mm-hmm. And race is a huge part of how we experience the world. And so credit University of Texas for being very, very vocal and forthcoming about that being how they teach kind of all the curriculum that we received there.
How do they then, and you now, define what comprises an anti-racist education?
That's a great question. So kind of thinking, and even though this text wasn't one that we were a part of, but I think that Ibram X. Kendi's work and definitions, he talks a lot about how definitions are a huge part of understanding and making, contextualizing what you're learning and experiencing. And so thinking about how race is a huge part of society that we can't, it helps make up our society, but thinking about how racism is an idea of not only ideas and beliefs, but policies, and anti-racism and an anti-racist educator is someone that is actively working to support anti-racist policies and ideas. So it's that constant movement that things aren't finished, that it's the personal work as well as the policy side is the that framework.
Yes, I think one of the most prominent aspects of what Kendi teaches is that power and policy and not people are what keep racism entrenched in society. And how do you see that playing out? I know you've touched on it a little bit and what you observed in your own classroom and so forth, but how do you see that teaching of his play out in the education sphere writ large?
I think it is, it's huge. Because I, you know, especially when we're in a field such as education, where we're working with parents, community members, students, and teachers, people that are for the most part, that are coming into, that are stakeholders in education, are wanting the best for kids or for their personal children or the kids in front of them. It takes constant work to think about how the systems have been set up for us to put forward our best efforts or kind of fulfill our passion or interest, but we're only working within what settings and systems that we've been a part of and that shaped our identity, that shaped how we see the world, how we react to situations, but just kind of reflecting on how those systems have been designed to keep the people that are in power, whether it's intentional or not. We're a part of that, and recognizing that and trying to learn as much as we can about our own unique understanding and the way that we, our role in that is something that I think is crucial, because as teachers, we have such a great privilege and responsibility. And so, and one of the things with Educators in Solidarity is, and our mission is, that we're uniquely situated to combat racism in our own, whatever our context is. And so, yeah.
Thank you so much for that answer. What would you say, Samantha, is required for an educator to be anti-racist?
I think I'm going to answer it broadly first, because I think as an administrator now, someone that works with a lot of teachers and someone that's hiring, looking for great educators, I think the best sign of a good teacher, period, is the ability to be reflective. So when something doesn't go right in a lesson, when a conversation doesn't go well with a parent, thinking that there's a lot of different things that could be happening, but always reflecting on what could I have done or prepared or researched or prepped differently to make that be more effective. And then when something does work well, reflect on how to make that continue that, so that way we're capitalizing on the times we have with students or conversations we're having with other educators, parents, et cetera. So I think reflection is a huge part of being an effective educator, period. And going into the anti-racist part of being an anti-racist educator, always reflecting on how your context and experience is impacting the way that you're instructing. So when you're reading a text, how does my lens and the way that I'm going to share this lens impact the way my students receive it? How am I coming in with fear or uncertainty in certain situations? How am I, if I feel like I'm too comfortable in something, why is that? Because I think once we get comfortable, that's when we stop growing and learning as people, but specifically as teachers. And so I think that is a huge part, because I know we've talked a little bit about systems and policies, but the self-awareness piece and thinking about what is my role in what am I about to do with these students or these adults that are in front of me is crucial to be an anti-racist educator.
Because systems are essentially comprised of people, right? So, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, but there's so much controversy now about talking about racism, talking about race, let alone racism and anti-racism in schools. What would you say, Samantha, by your own experience, is most misunderstood about anti-racism in education?
I think what's most misunderstood, there's a lot of things I want to say. I think that unfortunately what my mind goes to right now is the way the media and politicians have talked about critical race theory, for instance. And so the misinformation around what that is and who is learning about, like, that's something that we learned about in graduate school as a way to interpret systems and such. It's not something that's happening at an elementary level. It's one misunderstanding. But I think the biggest misunderstanding is that students want to talk about race. They want to talk about their identity. They see differences and they want to point it out and understand about others. And adults are far less comfortable doing that, because we've built up so many different ideas about our context and we're proud of our heritage in certain senses, or trying to make sure that we're protecting people that taught us, in a sense. And so I think that educators and adults are fearful of what kids might say. They're fearful of doing the wrong thing, but students are not. And students are very willing to learn and to change their mind and change their perspective. And leaning into that is such a gift that we have as teachers. And so I think that's the biggest misunderstanding, is that school is not a place for that, but that's where students learn to have discourse and learn about the world. And so kids are ready for so much more than we give them credit for.
I so love that answer. You know, it's as though there's this misunderstanding that race and racism are being talked about as an abstraction versus, mm-hmm. you know, kids coming to school, having observed and heard and read in papers and such, all of these things that are happening in our world that have everything to do with race. And they're looking for ways to understand and interpret that. And how shall that happen if not in and through the school, and obviously in partnership with parents and the community at large, but in the school, they're seeking understanding of these things. So I love, 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 love the way you have framed that, Samantha. And of course, I want our listening audience to learn more about educators in solidarity. So can you tell us a little bit about what that is and how that got started and your role in it?
Absolutely. So Educators in Solidarity was founded in 2014, following the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Mm-hmm. One of my friends and a current member of Educators in Solidarity, as well as one other educator, were from St. Louis. And so that hit really close to home. And following that event, there was a huge movement across the country and a national call out for teachers of, how do we talk about this with other teachers? How do we talk about this with students? How do we talk about race, police brutality, and what is our role in that? So a few teachers came together just to have coffee and talk about, share resources and kind of talk through that. And so those two teachers, one of them, there's about eight teachers that were there. Another one was a member of our cohort at the University of Texas. And so they just committed to meeting monthly about that, how to be a support system for each other and learning more.
Nice.
And so I joined the conversations probably 6 or 8 months after it had began, luckily, because both my roommates were a part of those conversations. And so from then, the organization and the purpose has built. So our vision is to build our collective capacity as anti-racist educators. And yeah. I'm sure a lot of things that I talk about will come back to that phrase of collective capacity. And so not only working on ourself and our own lens, but how do we grow that together? Mm-hmm. We're working to build that through advocacy and outreach. And so understanding that we do have that unique privilege and position as educators, and what is our role? And so it kind of began there and then began to grow, finding partner organizations. So kind of just knowing that we have experience and perspective as educators, but we need to be joining in on work that's already happening. And so, for example, Austin Justice Coalition does a lot of excellent work in the Austin community. And so that was one of the first partners that EIS had to kind of see how we could fit into their educational initiatives. So since then, it's just grown. And we have several partners now around Central Texas. I think our members now, we have members in 6 different school districts, as well as graduate students. And so it's been a really great network and way to expand. We have had 2 conferences a year for the past several years. We've had 9, we call them unconferences, and have worked to expand our outreach and advocacy and legislative work as well, both at the state level as well as local school board level. And that's a lot of the work that I help support within EIS. And so I'm one of our policy and engagement facilitators. And so that comes down to a lot of relationship building and just continual conversations and understanding, sharing more of what we know and then learning about what we don't know and how we can plug in to be voices for equity in our community and how we can support our students. And so that's a little bit about the history. It's been really exciting work to be a part of, and a lot's happened in the past eight years. Yeah. And so it's very grateful for the support system there.
Well, much to be commended there. And I'm really intrigued. You talked about conferences and unconferences and this incredible rate of growth to 6 school districts. I'm wondering, you know, what is the experience that the educator has when he or she becomes a part of Educators in Solidarity? You know, what is there a learning journey that you hope that all will go on, or They just pick it up by participating in the unconferences and such. What's the path?
Yeah, thanks for that question. So we have a path to membership that, so we have monthly meetings, and it involves coming to at least one monthly meeting and then two other events within 6 months. And then coming to at least one event every 6 months after that. And so it's a pretty, it's not a very difficult way to become a member, but we do think the monthly meetings in particular are very crucial for that. And the reason being is that we start every meeting and really every event with Educators in Solidarity with our history and sharing about what started the and what was the mission from the beginning. And that was one of curiosity and wanting to understand race and how our role in that and how we can best support following a very tragic event. And so sharing about the history, and then we always have a racial self-reflection. And so that, and a lot of that, and I credit as well to some of the research and support at the University of Texas and some of the mentors that the original group of leaders had there. And so we do have a racial self-reflection every month. And so that is very crucial, I think, to the purpose of EIS, to make sure they're always thinking about our own context and own growth, that we've never, you know, made it. We do a lot with the Courageous Conversations framework, where there's, you know, there's you're never finished and you're never fully satisfied. That's not the right phrase. Expect non-closure. That's it. So that you should expect and expect. Accept and expect non-closure. And so we have our monthly meeting, and then we have kind of the action time. So either if any of our partners have events that we can get volunteers for or support for, if there's anything if with policy work that we're needing to do research on, then we kind of have some work time. And so that's why the monthly meetings is a part of that path to membership. And then there's a lot of opportunities beyond that. So we have our unconferences, and we call them unconferences because it's the idea that there's the rule of 2 feet is one of them, where you can kind of go from to and from different sessions depending on what your learning need is. Now that we're on a Zoom a lot more, kind of rule of 2 fingers, I guess, as you're clicking through. And also that it's more of a conversation. So instead of sitting and taking in, that it's a more active experience is the hope. And that we're also always unlearning and relearning what we know. So that's kind of the concept of our unconferences. And we do have a lot of traction and support and interest during those times. And it's also a great time to really uplift the work of our partner organizations that are Black and Brown led organizations within Central Texas. So uplifting a lot of those voices and learning from experts around us, and then educators in the classroom that might not present at conferences or have different opportunities, but are getting to share a lot about restorative practices, data analysis, things like that. And so those are great opportunities and really ways that kind of revitalize us, because a lot of times I think that when we get too deep in the work, specifically policy work right now with legislature and things like that, so you play a lot of defense or kind of have to hear a lot of negative rhetoric. And so our unconferences do a lot of that uplifting and freedom dreaming work that we get really passionate about. And so those are our main things. We also have typically have monthly listening circles with local elected officials. And so it's a great way to kind of maintain relationships. And
listening circles with local elected officials?
Yeah. So we,
wow.
This, we began, maybe in spring of 2020, one of our local state representatives had been very supportive of our work and offered to have a listening circle where he would ask questions and we would, members of the community that were either educators, students, parents. And so it's kind of a way to uplift those voices. And following summer of 2020 and following George Floyd's murder, there was a lot of, I guess, a revitalization of the idea of anti-racism and trying to support it. So we got a lot more interest. It also was around election time as well and going into the fall. And so we kind of built off of that momentum and people's interests. And I think we've had about 250 participants, and we've had about 50 elected officials that have waited from state representatives to school board and city council members. And then, and also being in Central Texas, there's a lot of different school districts around us. And so it's just a great way for kind of to also have kind of model that leading with curiosity, because a lot of times elected officials are speaking and feeling like they have to know everything. So it's kind of a great way to let them ask questions and uplift community voices. And so that's something that kind of brings a lot of people in too, because they want a chance to be heard and in a safe space. And so yeah, that's kind of been that. There's a lot of exciting activities, but also and events, but those monthly meetings are very crucial to kind of be reminded of the purpose and the individual work and reflection that we should all be having, as well as the action work of anti-racism.
That is so commendable. And I'm really intrigued. You talked about community voice being represented as well and respected in this process. And that might not come across immediately when someone hears about educators and solidarity, but it certainly is consistent with the way that the NEA Foundation thinks about how education systems are improved, that it's a process of family, school, and community partnership, right? How are those community voices made integral to the work of educators in solidarity? Is it predominantly through these public forums, or is there some ongoing means?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we get a lot of ideas and perspective, particularly from parents in these events. We found it to more so than... I say this, we've gotten a lot of feedback from school board members that it's been a very authentic way for parents, particularly Black parents that are not heard from at the school board level, to have a space to connect and to make their voice known. Because I don't think that, you know, there's just avenues that are not as accessible at times. So that's been really encouraging to hear that feedback. But as we take notes of kind of themes that we hear throughout that informs our work and especially helps us in deciding what to research or support further in terms of action steps. But we also every year will revisit our bylaws with our membership and our points of unity to see what way is our organization growing. One way I think that it's really developed and grown throughout the year is looking at the intersectionality and supporting efforts with LGBTQIA organizations and how that intersects with anti-racism and what is our role in that as well, and kind of taking the lead of some of our community partners with that as well. But that has come up frequently in our listening circles. And so taking the time to yearly reflect on those bylaws and points of unity and making that a process that anyone can provide input on that's a member, I think has really helped provide us with a North Star, but also be open to growth and reflection along the way. And so I think that those opportunities have helped inform those decisions as well.
Thank you so much, Samantha. There's a lot you've said that by inference I can partially answer this question, but I'd like to know, you know, with all of this, what have you seen as the impact on the school community?
I think that there's a ripple effect in a sense. One, that there's, and I don't want to speak for just myself, but I've heard this from several members or people that have had been in events with us, that there's a safe place or a safe person to get ideas or feedback from of how can I improve my teaching? How can I, if I presented this, what do you think about that? Not thinking that one person has the right answer, but just having a thought partner of how to best support and serve students, as well as having a support system when you've noticed inequities or harmful practices on your campus, and having someone that will be beside you to go talk to an administrator or a colleague about that. And I think that that's something that it, as an administrator now, I've been fortunate to kind of see the way that the idea of collective capacity is so important and allows for true growth and accountability. And that accountability is important, and it's a big part of relationships. If you have a relationship with your students or with your colleagues, you do want to be held accountable and want to improve. And so I think that it helps provide an example or a support of vulnerability, as well as strength, that you have people to collaborate with, as well as if you're not feeling that on your campus, knowing that you have someone at the campus down the street that you can call for advice if you don't feel like you have created or are part of a ripple effect at your campus and you're wanting a model or of how I heard the school has done a great job with having a equity committee on their PTA. Could you connect me with them? I want to talk further. Or what would be a script or an idea of how as a parent, I could talk to a teacher that I feel is not treating my child fairly, for instance. And so I just think it provides hope and support for a lot of people. And that's something I've been very grateful for, is to have that network that has been either on my campuses or at campuses nearby where I can get that feedback and be held accountable myself and also provide a support where I can. And so I'm hopeful. And I do think that that's what it provides for the majority of people that have been associated with Educators in Solidarity.
Thank you, Samantha. And you haven't mentioned, but I can only imagine that at some point you have encountered a little pushback on the work of Educators in Solidarity. And I'm wondering, when you have encountered that, how you've responded, how you even perceive that.
I think that's a great question. My brain went multiple different places at once. One is that one thing that's very interesting about being in an organization that does have members and is involved in several different school districts and areas is I've gotten to see the way that my context and the way that some of the work that I might do on my campus is received differently than others, because I'm in Austin Independent School District that has a cultural proficiency and inclusiveness department that it pairs with social emotional learning. So I feel like the work is bolstered and supported in my district, and down, you know, at a district down the road, it might not be the same. And so there's different pushbacks. But I do think that what's interesting about that as well is that we also can help create that pressure and accountability that, you know, look at this great work that these teachers are getting to do in this one district versus another, and having relationships with different school districts and board members and educational leaders, it's been helpful to kind of provide that pressure and learning how to that. So that way we are providing a more liberatory experience for students. And so that came to mind. Also came to mind just kind of some data discussions that I've been a part of on campuses where there's been pushbacks by other teachers that, you know, we can't just blame race. We have to, you know, put accountability on students. And so how do we have, and it's good conversation and thinking about, are we putting, what's the language we're using? How can I change my language? And that, and think about how, if we're looking at data through one lens, what other lenses are we looking through as well? If we're dissecting through gender, through race, what are different ways that are we looking at? How do we strengthen our system so that these things are not a predictor of student success, while also having that accountability for students so that they are aware and can control their own data? So there has been definitely pushback in that area. And then the last thing I thought of is that I feel like, in comparison to some members of EIS, have not received as much pushback. I mean, I'm a white woman that has a graduate degree. Now I'm an administrator, so I do have that title as well. That's one thing that's been very helpful to be a part of EIS, is getting to have those conversations with educators of color that are not being received in the same way. And so how can I be a voice in those spaces? And then also thinking, as an administrator, what are ways that I'm listening to different voices in my own community? But I think that's helped me be aware that I can say things that others might be more hesitant to say because they've had experiences where they have had more pushback than myself. And so, yeah, so I think I've received less pushback than others and other members of EIS, for certain, because of those privileges that are just part of my identity.
Well, that's a wonderful answer. And I appreciate your own self-reflection in that response, Samantha. And I'm glad that you have been free to pursue the work that you're doing through Educators in Solidarity as you have. I have to say, time flies. My goodness.
Yes.
And yeah, we're nearing the end of the time that we'll be able to spend together today, Samantha. And as we approach it, this podcast is very much focused on, we like to highlight solutions to the struggles that we might be facing or the situations that we encounter as we endeavor to bring the very best to students through public education. And our approach to that is one where we believe everyone has something to contribute to students' improved experience. And we like to ensure that in the course of a podcast, we will have given folks not only insight and greater understanding perhaps to an issue, but some actionable ideas with which they can make that contribution. So when we think about all that you have experienced and learned through Educators in Solidarity and your own personal experience, I'm wondering what ideas you might have for the listener about how we all can support and be a part of liberatory education, anti-racist education, as you've described it today.
I think one thing is that, you know, the feelings work that is so important and the reflection work is so valuable, but having something to base that off of, creating or finding, there's plenty of tools on the online for like an equity audit that could happen on your campus or in your classroom or the university, whatever your context is. That was something that was a practice that has I did at the graduate level, but then has been a part of many campuses that I've been at as well. And I think that's really helpful to see just on paper, how many students do we have involved in this organization? How many students do we have that are multilingual learners that are a part of this versus not? Are we representing all of our populations appropriately in gifted and talented services or in special education? Are we over-identifying or under-identifying anywhere? And just taking it as information and then seeing what questions come from that. And then when we have those questions, where can that lead to action steps? So, because it's great to have ways to reflect, but having something that comes back to, we want to meet the need of all students. How do we do that? And this is where an area where we can grow. And I also think that self-reflection piece is so important. The monthly racial self-reflections have been very helpful just to understand own identity. And so encouraging taking steps in that direction to understand your own strengths and areas of growth and the valuable ways that you see the world and ways that you might not have a right frame of reference for certain experiences. And the last thing would be just finding a people to learn alongside you. Either if there's educators that are interested in your area in the same work or organizations that are already providing experiences and learning opportunities, how do you get plugged in? Because it can be very exhausting work. There can be a lot of pushback. It can sometimes feel that it's very isolating. And so always having a support and people to be in solidarity with you is the most important thing, because burnout is very real in education and particularly in this field in this time. And so that would be a very crucial piece as well. So that reflection, data to build off of, and then finding people to be your support along the way.
Wow. Well, Samantha, you are a treasure. And
thank you. You are really, as well.
You really, really are. And I am so grateful for your willingness to be vulnerable and open and honest about your experience and what you're trying to accomplish and have accomplished in Texas. So appreciative of all of your time. I'm sure our listeners also are going to leave this call with a greater sense of optimism about what is possible and what some of the good things that are happening in other parts of the country. And so, unfortunately, though, we have come to the close of our time together. And I want to just thank you, Samantha. We know at the NEA Foundation that there are many, many educators around the country who are committed to making a positive change right where they are, educators like you. And so to our listeners, I know that you are probably applauding on your end, Samantha Greenleaf, for her contributions today. And I want to encourage you that if you have enjoyed this podcast today, we certainly hope that you will be a regular subscriber to the Up Close Podcast with Sarah Sneed. And you can access our podcast wherever you listen. So thank you for being with us today. And I look forward to being with you again real soon.